competed nearby in potato sack and three-legged races. This was the first official gathering of the family in a dozen years, conceived for the Labor Day weekend as a way to honor the relevance of work in the Izzo family's story. The older generation of barbers, beauticians, plumbers, tailors, carpenters, butchers, coal business operators, and the next generation's rising lawyers, teachers, coaches, insurance brokers, army intelligence officers. In the midst of their energetic consumption, three generations of Izzos also consecrated the memory of Laura and Antonio, the southern Italian immigrants from the mountain village of Vietri de Potenza, and toasted the family's continued good health, including the safe return of all its servicemen. For Vince Lombardi at age 34, the reunion was in line with an emerging theme of home and rebirth. He and Marie had two children of their own now, 5-year-old Vincent and infant Susan, born the previous February 13th, despite a doctor's ominous prediction that Marie would never bear a healthy baby. And while maintaining his home in Englewood, Vince had returned to work on familiar fields east of the Hudson. During his last year at Saints, he had scoured the college ranks for an assistant coaching position, sending feelers as far away as St. Louis with no success. One rejection letter, from a former Fordham teammate coaching at a Midwestern school, included a quote from their old coach, Sleepy Jim Crowley. "No future in coaching, try something else." Among the jobs Lombardi sought was the head position at Fordham, which had resumed playing football in 1946 after dropping it for 3 years during the war. The school instead hired another football alumnus, Edward F. Donowski, who had been a senior during Lombardi's freshman year, then went on to quarterback the New York Football Giants from 1934 to 1941 before enlisting in the Navy. Donowski had only one season of high school coaching experience and a modest interest in the profession. He began with a paltry $5,000 salary, a late start on recruiting and one assistant coach, and his first year at Fordham was a predictable disaster. After that season, the football boosters raised money to fund 30 new scholarships and beefed up the coaching staff, bringing in Lombardi as one of several new assistants. The first day of fall practice was scheduled on Rose Hill for the Tuesday after the Izzo family picnic. Lombardi's official responsibilities at Fordham were to teach physical education, coach the freshman squad, and install the T-formation offense. All for $3,500 a year. Behind the scenes came intimations from several influential alumni, as well as athletics director Jack Coffey, that Lombardi would be the head man himself soon enough, the one to lead a Rams football renaissance, returning the school to the pride of the days when Grantland Rice and Damon Runyon covered the 7 blocks of granite. This was the job Lombardi coveted. There was nowhere he would rather be, he told friends, than leading young men in maroon on the sidelines at the polo grounds on Saturday afternoons in late October, head coach of Fordham in games of national consequence against Tennessee or Syracuse or Army. Big-time football meant the same thing to Lombardi that it did to most sport fans in those early post-war days. It meant the college game. Lombardi's dream, in truth, was more romantic than realistic. The fact that Fordham's Jesuit administrators had scrapped football for 3 years during the war was only one signal of their diminishing interest in the game, at least at the highest collegiate levels. The Reverend Robert Gannon, who had once suspended young Lombardi for fighting, was still Fordham's president, and his distaste for the professionalization of college football had only intensified in the decades since Vince's playing days. His philosophy corresponded with the latest concerns of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, which had recently adopted what was alternately called a sanity code or purity code, calling for strict amateurism and limits on financial aid and recruiting. Scandals seemed to be erupting with regularity on campuses around the nation. some of them, too many for Gannon's taste, involving Catholic institutions. The coach of the University of San Francisco Dons was soon to resign with the announcement that 22 of his top players had been paid for their talents. Gannon was so fearful of scandal that he hoped Fordham would never be good enough to get caught up in one. He'd concluded, he acknowledged to one local alumni group, that football brought his school little benefit financially, scholastically, socially, or athletically. The more successful teams, he said, merely attracted gamblers and their corrupting milieu. With the intention of keeping Rams football strictly collegiate, Gannon and his faculty advisor for athletics, the Reverend Kevin J. O'Brien, had developed a policy even stricter than the NCAA code. Along with a de-emphasis on recruiting, the Fordham plan called for the construction of a small stadium on Rose Hill so that football would seem more connected to college life and less a separate business enterprise. Gannon was already withdrawing, rhetorically at least, from the addictive narcotic of sellout crowds at colossal city stadiums by calling the Mara family extortionists for the rents they were charging at the polo grounds. The trend surely must have been apparent to Lombardi, but he plunged into his new job with only winning football on his mind. He'd been separated from the college game for 10 years, away from the tumultuous big city crowds, the inflating Gotham press corps, the prospect of national recognition, and he told friends that he was determined to recover lost time. After accepting the Fordham position in late January 1947, he taught at Saints for the remainder of the second semester, but began commuting over to the Bronx in the afternoons to work out with the Rams and lead them through spring drills. On at least two occasions, he brought along a carload of Saints seniors and suited them up in Fordham uniforms to practice with the returning veterans, a surreptitious and perhaps illegal recruiting move that ran counter to Gannon's dictates. It was difficult to distinguish the college players from the Saints, Lombardi noted afterwards, boasting and complaining simultaneously, except that the Saints hit harder. One among them, his little brother Joe, was eager to free himself at last after being physically and emotionally banged around by his big brother all his life and escaped north to St. Bonaventure. But many of the Saints' former backfield stars followed Lombardi to Rose Hill, in accompaniment with his T-formation and his cause to rediscover lost Fordham glory. Fordham had never had a freshman class quite like the one that arrived in 1947. This wasn't just a collection of pink-faced teenage boys from Catholic prep schools. Here were many men in their 20s who'd gone directly from high school graduation into the military during World War II and were now finally in college, as eager as their new freshman football coach to recoup lost time and move on quickly with their careers. Lombardi's squad of first-year players included three of his old backs from Saints: Dick Doheny, Billy White, and Larry Higgins, all returned from the service, along with a 23-year-old center named Herb Seidel, who had been in the Navy with Leo Paquin, left end in the Seven Blocks. Seidel certainly was not the poster boy for Father Gannon's restricted recruiting guidelines. He was a blatant ringer who'd already played varsity football at Purdue before the war. In theory, he should have sat out a year before resuming his playing career, but in practice, as he later recalled, all the rules were looser because of the war. Once again, the fallacy of the innocent past. Seidel not only played for Lombardi's freshmen, he was also elected their captain. Again, on Rose Hill, with all the familiar sounds, sights, and smells, dank gymnasium office, Trainer Jake's old barber chair, the Keating Hall clock tower, Jesuits in cassocks clucking along, lunches of linguine and calamari on Arthur Avenue, leaves and mud on the practice field, thud and smack of leather upon leather as dusk enveloped the Bronx, maroon and gold. We do or die notes drifting over from band rehearsal. Lombardi was in his element, restored. football as religion. The tea, a catechism from which he preached. And God was in the details. In Lombardi's pedagogical style, there was an exact method to hundreds of precise movements in the tee. Some coaches concerned themselves with how laces were tied, or shirts tucked, or helmets held on the sidelines before a game. Lombardi concentrated on the minutiae of play itself. He'd refined the tee in the years since Doheny and White had played for him at Saints, and was refining it still. He was the patient scholar, devoting hours each day to breaking down and analyzing the elements again and again. The snap. There had to be a quarter-turn rotation on the ball, no more or less. Hold it right there. Let's see. Quarter-turn, Seidel. That's right. Now pop the ball against the fanny. The cheater. The halfback 3.5 steps behind the quarterback. The fullback 4. Now he got them to cheat up another half foot to run them through the hole a split second quicker. Not a foot. That would throw off the timing completely. It had to be a half foot. The ballet. Lombardi's favorite. He could work on it all day. He stood there with the center and his 3 quarterbacks and a posse of running backs and got out his stopwatch to time the play from snap to handoff. It was all in speed and dexterity, he said. The center had to anticipate the count to snap the ball in a split second. Then the quarterback had to jump spin to the handoff position in time for the cheater running back. Faster. One fluid movement. The jump spin was ballet, he said. When Doheny did it right, beautiful ballet. And Doheny could do it right. He was unflappable, concise in everything he did. Not much of a runner, but Lombardi didn't ask him to run. He had to hand off and pass. Not the greatest arm, but he knew when and where to throw it. His teammates called him a cool cat. He was Lombardi on the field, the earliest coming of Bart Starr, the coach's star quarterback in Green Bay decades later. There were blocking codes along the line, 3 or more options per position on a play, but also simple reads and reasons for every move. With repetition, this seemed obvious, intuitive, and the young Rams learned their lessons well. They became so adept at the tee that by October they were embarrassing the varsity in practice, galloping through the line at will during midweek scrimmages. They also appeared invincible in their 2 official games against other freshman teams, clobbering Rutgers and NYU in shutouts. The 12-0 defeat of Rutgers, during which the Fordham freshman held the Scarlet Knights to negative yards on offense while compiling more than 400 yards on the ground themselves and completing 12 of 17 passes, prompted an article in the New York Herald Tribune boasting that Coach Vinnie Lombardi can feel justly proud for a job well done, that his yearlings look like $1 million, and that they were certain to lift the Rams to the prestige they knew on the gridiron before the war, come 1948. The NYU game, won by Fordham 33-0, excited the press boosters even more, especially in contrast with Danowski's uninspiring 1-6-1 record with the varsity that year. At season's end, Lombardi was rewarded with a new job, but not the one he expected. He was asked, belatedly, to step in and coach Fordham's freshman basketball team. The job had become vacant when Bob Mulvihill, who was slated to coach the freshman, instead, unexpectedly, was declared eligible to play one final year with the varsity after returning from the Marine Corps as a 25-year-old senior. Lombardi had been a successful high school basketball coach, leading one of his Saints teams to a regional championship during the war years, so he was considered the logical replacement. In fact, he had no interest in the job, and knew less about the game than most of the Rams players. One of the freshman cagers that winter was Dick Tarrant, who later became a respected basketball coach at Richmond University. As Tarrant remembered that season, Lombardi was an odd mentor, largely preoccupied with football. The players respected him and dared not challenge him. They learned that if practice was at 3 o'clock, they were wise to show up at 2:30. He made them run laps, which was absurd in basketball, Tarrant noted, since basketball scrimmages were non-stop running in any case, and set them up in a simple offense from which he would not stray. But for the most part, he left the players alone, realizing that their skills surpassed his knowledge and interest in the sport. He didn't know any of us and didn't really care to. He was babysitting us for that year, Tarrant said. Often, while the team was shooting baskets or running layup drills, Lombardi slipped off to a corner of the gym where a huddle of football players waited, and he went through the snap and ballet with his center and quarterbacks. The basketball team appeared bulky and overpopulated at times, as Lombardi brought linemen in to run laps with lanky forwards and guards. Sometimes at night, after studying football films for an hour, he walked across the campus hill against the howling winter wind and encountered a pack of athletes trudging back from dinner to their dorm in a former army barracks behind the gym. He would ignore the basketball players in the group and focus his attention on the shivering gridmen. Did you work out today? Do your sit-ups? The basketball players appreciated their anonymity. Not only was Lombardi's energy elsewhere, but also his wrath. Lombardi that winter was nonetheless, as usual, intense and nervous for better or worse. His will to compete was inevitably contagious, even in a sport that mattered less to him. During a meaningless freshman basketball game against Hofstra, Wagner, or St. John's, played 2 hours before the varsity contest, with only a few girlfriends and student loiterers in the stands, a gym so empty that you could hear the vendor selling popcorn and Coke behind the stands on the other side of the court, Lombardi might launch into one of his eye-blinking spasms in response to a referee's ill-conceived foul call. There was one other characteristic that his basketball players never forgot about Lombardi, the freshman basketball coach. He had a noticeably nervous digestive system. Before every game, he would be in the crapper. He would flush and we'd all giggle, Tarrant recalled. And he spent most of halftime in the bathroom with the runs. I always wondered whether coaching placed an increasing strain on his colon. Lots of times, if you have colitis, the doctor will ask, "Are you under stress?" Potato Ed, they called Ed Danowski, and that aptly described his coaching style. He had many attributes: athletic grace, handsome looks, sincere demeanor, but charisma was not one of them. No more sizzle than a half-baked spud. When Fordham's freshman class of 1947 moved up to the varsity the next season, so too did Lombardi, and though he wasn't promoted to head coach, he did most of the coaching, intellectual and spiritual, while Potato Ed, as one player described it, stood in the corner and chewed tobacco. Fordham ran the T as Lombardi taught it, and entered the season with raised expectations, which were rudely dashed with an opening 53-14 loss to a middling Lafayette team. The situation deteriorated from there, with losses to Canisius, Georgetown, Boston University, and Holy Cross. It was the first time in his career that Lombardi felt direct responsibility for losing, and with each loss he grew more intense and inventive, throwing as many trick plays as he could scheme up into his basic tee. Fordham simply didn't have the skill and depth yet to compete again at the big-time level. This mattered not at all to Father Gannon, who'd already expressed his preference for safe losing and mediocrity, and it had no discernible effect on the disposition of Potato Ed, who shook it off with the sanest retort a losing football coach could summon, that it was only a game, not life and death. Alumni boosters and their cohorts in the press box were fed up, however, and began hectoring for change. There were suggestions of bringing back Hugh DeVore, a former assistant to Sleepy Jim Crowley, then coaching at St. Bonaventure, and even the fanciful notion that Frank Leahy, Another former assistant could be lured back from his prestigious post at Notre Dame. But most of the public speculation centered on Lombardi. Rumor mill. Danowski out? Queried a headline in the New York Post with 2 weeks to go in the season. The story said Vin Lombardi, who gained fame as one of the Rams' renowned seven blocks of granite, was said to be in line for Danowski's spot. The New York Journal-American's Barney Kremenko followed up with the change as a fait accompli, saying Danowski's days were numbered, and that alumni had tabbed Lombardi as their man as far back as a year ago when he coached the Frosh to victories over NYU and Rutgers. But the fact that Danowski's contract had another year to run caused complications, and the embarrassing matter was dropped. In his Sports Chatter column, Harry Singer offered the opinion that Danowski's lack of color and personality were the main reasons he would be replaced by Lombardi, who's rated just the opposite from the present Ram coach and who will make personal appearances and is a good mixer. Lombardi neither pushed the speculation nor made an effort to quash it. Every morning during his commute from Englewood to the Bronx, he fretted aloud about the stressful situation he found himself in. He expected to be made head coach and wanted the job, but he didn't want to be seen as Potato Ed's betrayer. He felt responsible for instructing the players, preparing them for each game, but it was still Danowski's team, and he was frustrated by not having true authority. As the controversy bubbled up around them, Danowski and Lombardi, barely on speaking terms, nonetheless devoted themselves to ending the season in respectable fashion. The Rams played spiritedly while losing to Rutgers in the penultimate game, after which a sympathy backlash for Potato Ed began to emerge. Leading sports writers who'd covered him during his days with the Giants began to comment on his goodwill and decency. President Gannon, working behind the scenes against the blatant move by some alumni to restore big-time football at Fordham, was only too willing to become a private source for pro-Danowski stories. Danowski was also aided by the neutrality of the most influential member of the Alumni Advisory Board, Wellington Mara, owner of the New York Giants. Then and later, Mara's relationship with Lombardi was overstated by many. They had been classmates at Fordham, but were not pals. Mara felt just as close to Danowski, who'd been one of his players with the Giants for 8 seasons. "I don't know that I had any role," Mara said decades later of the dispute. "But I tried to stay away from that whole thing." The players were torn. Some considered Potato Ed a dolt. A few thought Vince was a martinet. But most of them liked both men for decidedly different reasons. Danowski's ease, Lombardi's contagious will to win. On the weekend before the season finale against NYU, Herb Seidel, the team captain, was called home to Indiana to care for his father, who had fallen off a ladder. When he returned on the Friday after Thanksgiving, the day before the game, he could sense an enormous amount of strain in the locker room. Players were being called in one by one to talk to Father O'Brien about the coaching situation. O'Brien told Seidel that he was taking an informal poll and that the players seemed to be unanimous in their support of Danowski. "Well," Seidel responded, "all the players knew who was doing the coaching. It was Lombardi." He left the meeting convinced that the cards were stacked against Vinny and that the administration was trying to create the illusion of support for Danowski. The next day, Fordham played its finest game of the year, smothering NYU 26-0, and the salvation of Potato Ed was assured. If Ed Danowski's job as head coach of Fordham wasn't saved by that endorsement his players gave him in chalking up the traditional game with the Violets for their beloved mentor, wrote Dan Parker in the New York Mirror, then there's no bomb in Gilead. The bomb arrived a week later, after a long Friday night meeting between Father O'Brien, acting on behalf of President Gannon, and Jack Coffey, the athletics director. It was arranged that Donowski would receive a new contract and a raise. He was to fire two of his assistants but keep Lombardi, even though Donowski had made it clear that he could not stand the sight of his threatening aide. If this was a compromise, it was not a happy arrangement, noted Tim Cohane, who had been following the careers of Lombardi and other former Fordham athletes since his days as the school's publicist. Cohane had left Fordham in 1940 to enter the world of major sports journalism, his longtime ambition. He started at the New York World Telegram, writing a column entitled Frothy Facts, and covering college football and the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team. Then in 1945, he moved on to Look magazine, where he served as sports editor. He was still plugged in at Fordham, and in fact had been lobbying for Lombardi's takeover of the football program. When that maneuver flopped, he received word that Vince and his dream of leading the Rams back to national glory were crushed. Lombardi had not found his way home after all, but had merely drifted through two more lost years. He needed a way out again. The man who had created the mythology of the seven blocks of granite soon had another plan for him. One school, one football program, stirred Cohane's soul as much as the old maroon. On an afternoon in early December, he met his favorite coach, Colonel Earl H. Red Blake, of Army, at the Eastern College Athletic Association meetings at the Biltmore Hotel in New York. On the way to dinner, Blake casually mentioned that he was losing his offensive line coach and needed a replacement. "Know anyone?" Blake asked. "Yes, sir," Cohane said. He thought he knew just the right man for the job. Chapter 6 Fields of Friendly Strife. Lombardi drove north from Englewood up Route 9W, high above the Hudson River. The roadway along the Palisades, framed by fresh snowbanks and slicked with sleet and ice. He was on his way to the United States Military Academy at West Point on this December morning in 1948, a brave new world for him, and the journey was not an easy one. When he reached Thayer Gate at the south end of the academy, he declared that he had an appointment with the football coach, then negotiated his way up Mills Road past Michi Stadium and Lusk Reservoir, and down toward the gymnasium. Even in the somber shroud of early winter, the panorama was at once majestic and intimidating. Massive stone everywhere, barracks and cliff, Gothic spire, long gray coats, vast snowy plain, broad cold river. When Lombardi reached the gym, he rode the elevator to the top floor and climbed another flight of stairs to an office in the tower. There in front of him, at the secretary's desk talking to an aide, stood Colonel Red Blake, the man Lombardi had come to see. He was an imposing sight, 6'2", lean and immaculate at age 51, with bronze hair and serious pale blue eyes. "Sid, take a look at the hands on this man," Blake said when Lombardi extended his butcher boy thick right hand in greeting. "Easy to see why he was a block of granite." He was talking to Sid Gilman, his line assistant, who was leaving to coach at the University of Cincinnati and whose position Lombardi hoped to fill. Blake's seeming familiarity with the seven blocks of granite was in fact rehearsed. He knew nothing of Lombardi before a recent briefing from Tim Cohane, who had brokered the interview, and he harbored doubts that Lombardi's coaching background prepared him for this job. The men retreated to the coach's inner sanctum, warm lighting, dark walnut paneling. On one wall, in bronze, hung a West Point coat of arms. Behind Blake's mahogany desk, on which stacks of mail were neatly piled, was a large, framed photograph of a saluting General Douglas MacArthur, commander of U.S. military forces in the Far East, who had been superintendent at West Point when Blake played football there shortly after World War I. MacArthur was Blake's hero, the number one fan of Army football. pleasantries quickly gave way to the substance of the job interview, a doctoral examination on football methodology. "What pulling technique do you teach your offensive guards?" Blake asked his prospective assistant. "The crossover step," Lombardi answered, rising from his chair to demonstrate the move he'd learned under Sleepy Jim Crowley and Frank Leahy at Fordham, swinging his right arm back in a fluid motion to propel the quickest turn. "The idea is to pull with speed and still be under control so you can assume a hitting position quickly," Lombardi explained. Blake pressed on. "What technique do you teach guards for turning up into the hole?" Again, Lombardi returned to the fundamentals he'd learned from Leahy, his former line coach, who was now gaining national renown as head coach at Notre Dame. "Drop the outside shoulder," Vince said, "and push off the outside foot." "On defense," Blake asked next, "do you favor the forearm shiver or the forearm left?" "I think there's a place for both," Lombardi said, hedging slightly. "But I personally favor striking the opponent under the shoulders with a forearm left." "Why?" Blake asked. "With the shiver," Lombardi answered, "if you miss, they're into your belly right away." He tried to sound authoritative, but had no idea whether he was making points with the unrevealing colonel. Blake continued with the gridiron interrogation. "What technique do you teach for downfield blocks?" "The roll block. If you miss the target," Lombardi explained, "he still backs away, and it's enough to tie him up." "That's what we teach," Blake said. The colonel was impressed. Lombardi seemed as taken with football nuance as he was. The question-and-answer session persisted for nearly 2 hours until Blake entered the interview and treated his guest to lunch at the officers' club. As Lombardi walked to his car for the drive back to Englewood, Blake seemed non-committal but encouraging. He said he would call. That night, Tim Cohane, curious about the results of his matchmaking, placed a call to Blake to see how it went. As Cohane later remembered the conversation, Blake said of Lombardi, "He's all right." Pressed further, Blake added, "He's a rough soul." Cohane knew that Blake was never impulsive in judgment, rarely effusive in praise, but was that a psychological assessment? A compliment? A criticism? Perhaps all three. The next day, Blake's office called Lombardi and asked him to return for another interview. This time, Vince rode the train north through more icy weather and met with Blake alone in the tower. Blake discussed West Point, the history of the academy, the winning tradition of the football team since he arrived as head coach in 1941, and then went over Lombardi's background and salary at Fordham. He never asked how much Lombardi wanted, but stated that the job would pay $7,000 with free housing included. He also mentioned that there was a grade school on the post for young Vincent, who was six, and his little sister, one-year-old Susan, when she reached school age. Blake cautioned that he had to gain final approval from the athletic board, but Lombardi descended from the tower this time knowing that he had the nod. It was not the top job that he'd yearned for. Still just an assistant's position. But being hired by Blake was nonetheless a significant achievement. Now he would be coaching in the big time and learning from the best. Blake was the dominant college coach of the 40s. He was an offensive wizard whose teams from 1944 through 1946, led by his famed tandem of backs Glenn Davis and Doc Blanchard, Mr. Outside and Mr. Inside, had amassed prodigious point totals, a tie with Notre Dame the only blemish on their record. His sixth-ranked 1948 team had also finished unbeaten, though not perfect, having been tied by Navy in the season-ending rivalry. Blake could hire virtually anyone he wanted, and he'd selected an assistant less than 2 years removed from a small Catholic high school in North Jersey. Before leaving West Point this time, Lombardi was shown around the post by another assistant coach, Doug Kenna, who'd played quarterback for Blake during the war years. Kenna found Lombardi engaging, but nervous and uncertain that he could adjust to the military environment. On New Year's Day, 1949, at 8 a.m, Lombardi attended his first meeting of the Army football staff. The holiday session was one of Blake's annual traditions, reinforcing the idea that no team in the nation would get the jump on Army. That was the essence of Red Blake, the most prepared man Lombardi had ever met. And there was much to get ready for this year. Blake had two new coaches under him, Lombardi for offense and another young bull, Murray Warmoth of Tennessee, for defense. 18 graduating lettermen had to be replaced, 7 of them defensive starters, and the schedule was more difficult than usual, with early games against top-ranked Michigan and Penn State. Lombardi and Warmoth had met once before. 15 years earlier, they had smacked each other around on a November afternoon in the polo grounds, Warmoth lining up at left guard for Tennessee, Lombardi at right guard for Fordham, which prevailed that day 13-12. Now the two tenderfoot coaches shared a desk in a communal war room below Blake's office and were brought together in a trying initial assignment. They were called up to the blackboard several hours each day for the first week, diagramming plays and formations, defending their ideas against Blake's piercing questions. It was a variation of Lombardi's first job interview, but this time for keeps. At one point, Lombardi found himself in a heated debate with Blake and the other assistants over the proper way to deliver the center snap to the quarterback. Blake had always taught the half turn of the ball, presenting it to the quarterback sideways. Lombardi preferred the quarter turn, with the ball reaching the quarterback at a slight angle. It was quicker, he said, and made it easier for the quarterback to hand off or pass. Blake disagreed. So they got out a ball and practiced both methods there in the conference room outside Blake's office. The quarter turn proved faster by a fraction of a second. When spring practice opened on March 12th, Lombardi began to appreciate the totality of Blake's preparedness. The coaches reported at 8 each morning, spent the first hour on correspondence, then convened at 9:15 for a staff meeting to establish the precise missions and chronology of that afternoon's practice, from the moment the players left the dressing room at 3:45 until they walked off the field at 5:15. The athletes had only a limited amount of time for football in their regimented days, sandwiched between final class and dinner formation at 6 o'clock, so nothing was left to chance. A set amount of time was devoted to each drill. 15 minutes for line blocks, 15 minutes for back blocks, 15 minutes for the blocking sleds, 15 minutes at the end for all the units to come together and work on new plays. Blake discouraged assistant coaches from bringing papers with them onto the field. They were expected to memorize the plays and blocking assignments of every player. At first, Lombardi had trouble keeping pace. "Run number 10," Blake commanded from the rear of the offensive unit, forcing his assistant to confess that he had not yet found time to install play number 10. Blake just gave me his bland Scott stare, as Lombardi later described the scene. "Run number 11, he'd order. After practice, the coaches broke for dinner, and then often were expected to return to the gym, sometimes working until midnight. Photographs and motion pictures had been taken of that day's practice and were developed and waiting for the assistants to study in the evening along with films of future opponents. Blake was a film fanatic, one of the first football coaches to analyze the game play-by-play, position-by-position, methodically charting another team's tendencies on each down at various positions on the field, and tuning his offense and defense in response to what he'd seen. When studying films of their own team, Blake and the assistants replayed the film to determine what every player did on each play, assigning grades based on the degree of execution. Football was Blake's life, his profession, and only hobby. He largely disdained the social scene beyond West Point and his house on the hill, where he and his wife Merle hosted parties for out-of-town guests on football Saturdays and group suppers for cadets on Sunday afternoons. He seemed to think about football 24 hours a day. Watching film was his idea of fun, work, and play. Once, after he and his staff had studied Michigan game footage for several hours in the projection room near his office, Blake turned to Warmoth and Lombardi and said, "You guys want to have some fun." It was a hot afternoon, and the assistants were restless. Warmoth dreamed of a round of golf. "Heck," said the colonel to his projectionist, "open up the locker and get those Navy films out. Let's look at those for a while." Even in the off-season, the focus on football was relentless. Lombardi would be halfway through dinner when the phone might ring and it was Blake saying, "I'll pick you up in 15 minutes." They would drive to the gym and discuss personnel or play ideas late into the night. It was then Lombardi first realized that football was a full-time, 12-month vocation. In many ways, the philosophy at West Point was similar to a way of life that Lombardi had learned earlier at Fordham from the Jesuits. There was a direct line from one to the next, from religion to the military to football, from the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius to the football regimen of Colonel Blake. Both emphasized discipline, order, organization, planning, attention to detail, repetition, the ability to adjust to different situations and remain flexible in pursuit of a goal while sustaining an obsession with one big idea. Lombardi was a daily communicant at both altars, absorbing what he learned from the Jesuits and Blake to become the leading apostle of the mystical discipline of football. As integral as religion was to his sense of self, it wasn't until he reached West Point and combined his spiritual discipline with Blake's military discipline that his coaching persona began to take its mature form. "Everything he knew about organizing a team and preparing it to play its best," Lombardi said later, "he learned at West Point. It all came from Red Blake." Lombardi wanted nothing more than to please Blake, a father figure who had the eminence and reserve that Harry Lombardi, old 5x5, lacked. Vince's bluster turned to obsequiousness when he was within range of the coach. At times he came across like a bootlicking corporal, snapping off refrains of "Yes, Colonel," and "Yes, sir," to Blake's slightest requests. Yet it's hard to imagine two less similar personalities than Red Blake, the Presbyterian Scotsman from the middle American town of Dayton, Ohio, and Vince Lombardi, the Italian Catholic from Sheepshead Bay. Blake was all understatement, reserved, aloof, stern, outwardly cool. He stood alone at practice, tall and straight in his army baseball cap, sweatshirt, football trousers cut off below the knee, and woolen socks, barking out crisp commands, rarely needing to modulate his tone of voice, just a nod and a look that said he could not be fooled. When he saw something that displeased him, he called the offender over and quietly explained what should have been done. He disciplined by way of teaching. His one curse word was "Jesus Katie," more often "Jeebers Katie." "And yet his presence was overwhelming," said Doug Kenna. "He radiated authority. He was really in charge." Lombardi was overstated, emotional, enthusiastic, explosive, hungry for stories and action, quick to laugh and cry and yell, his deep, distinctive voice reverberating across the practice field. He thrived on resistance, another force pushing back at him, physically and mentally, and he confronted the player spontaneously, swearing and steaming, all hands-on demonstrations, just like with the high school boys at Saints, demanding that the lineman hit him and he hit back. The irony was that the cadets spent most of their hours at West Point with someone in their face as they rehearsed drills on the plane and marched through archways to classes and meals and made their beds and lined up for inspection, always with someone vociferously demanding more of them. and they looked forward to football practice as a respite from the daily grind. Lombardi threatened the equilibrium. He came in attacking, and there was some culture shock at first. The players weren't accustomed to being confronted so vigorously. Some hated him for it. This was part of the rough soul that Blake saw in him and attempted to soften. "He toned down my temper, or tried to," Lombardi said of Blake years later. "When I'd get too intense and explosive on the field, he'd call me into the office the next day and sit there and look at me and twirl his class ring, West Point, 1920, and say, 'Vince, we just don't do it that way at West Point. You can't talk that way to cadets. You can't drive them that way because they're being driven all day.'" There was one dominating characteristic that Blake and Lombardi shared, an overwhelming will to win. "There was never any question that we were not allowed to lose," said Doug Kenna, who became one of Blake's closest friends as player and assistant coach. "That was the general attitude. We did lose, but it was a bleak day at West Point when that happened. To the poetic sportsman's code of Grantland Rice, that wins and losses meant less than how you played the game," Blake was once heard to reply with clean brevity, "Eyewash." He was a miserable loser, and proud of it. Blake posted his 10 football axioms on the walls of the Army dressing room. Axiom number 1 was about the distinction between losing and sportsmanship. "There never was a champion who to himself was a good loser. There is a vast difference between a good sport and a good loser." In Blake's opinion, the purpose of the game is to win. To dilute the will to win is to destroy the purpose of the game. In this, as in most matters, he was influenced by General MacArthur. He never forgot MacArthur's words. "There's no substitute for victory." MacArthur, or Dauntless Doug, as he was known by fellow cadets at the turn of the century, had played baseball for 3 years at West Point, a right fielder with a weak bat who willed himself on base. During his senior year, he managed the 1902 football team. By the time he returned to the Point 2 decades later to serve as superintendent from 1919 to 1922, he was a football man through and through, regarding it as another form of wargaming. When Blake and the other players of that era looked over at the sidelines during practice, invariably they caught sight of MacArthur pacing back and forth, riding crop in hand. Before he left that post for the Philippine Islands, his thoughts on the correlation between sport and war were carved in the stone portals of the gymnasium. "Upon the fields of friendly strife are sown seeds that upon other fields, on other days, will bear the fruits of victory." He followed Army football religiously from then on, scouring press guides and magazines, watching highlight films whenever possible, memorizing the biography of every player, even third stringers. Height, weight, age, hometown. Even during the toughest days of World War II, according to his wife, he spent hours thinking about Army football, one of the few diversions that could relax his mind. After Army walloped Navy 23-7 in 1944 to finish undefeated, MacArthur sent Blake a telegram saying that they had stopped the war to celebrate the magnificent success of the greatest of all Army teams. He was fascinated by Blake's coaching strategies and their parallels on the field of battle. When Blake became an early proponent of two-platoon football, using specialists on offense and defense, MacArthur remarked that this makes the game more and more in accord with the development of tactics of actual combat. Once, after Blake informed him that he'd lost both his line and backfield coaches, MacArthur lamented that it could not have failed to be a great blow. However, this again follows the technique of war, for you always lose your best men in the heat of battle. Blake and MacArthur were regular correspondents, their letters often touching on war, politics, friends, enemies, but always returning to their shared love of the minutiae of Army football. On July 30, 1949, as he made final preparations for the approaching season, Blake sent a 4-page, single-space type letter to MacArthur in Japan at General Headquarters of the Far East Command. He took note of the difficult schedule Army faced, the inexperience of his team, the arrival of 2 new assistants, Lombardi and Warmoth, the weights of top performers along the defensive line, his preference for 2-platoon football, and concerns that his defensive backs were too short and that his running backs were too dainty. MacArthur wrote back on August 8th, accurately reading between the lines of a coach's typical pessimism, saying that Blake's report fills me with hope that you will have a reasonably good season. An impression, MacArthur added, that was fortified by the magnificent results you have always been able to produce in the past. In closing, he asked Blake to tell the public relations officer to send me such literature as is put out about the team and keep me in touch with the results of the games during the season. We are way out on the end of the line here, and little news of the academy trickles through. That exchange of letters came during the one brief period of the year when Blake was on vacation of sorts, though he was not really away from football even then. During the final week of July and first week of August, he would retreat to Bull Pond, a fishing camp with 2 cabins on the West Point property about 8 miles southwest of campus. This was by tradition a stag affair, just Blake and his staff, a few Army Athletic Association officers, and a handful of sports writers. Lombardi was a first-time guest that year, and it was at Bull Pond that he developed friendships with 2 other West Point figures who later became significant influences on his life. Colonel Russell Red Reader, a one-legged marvel, hero of D-Day, who taught history and psychology, and was in charge of the athletic grounds, and Colonel Orrin C. Aki Kruger, assistant graduate manager of athletics, who was Blake's all-purpose aide-de-camp. From New York came Willard Mullen, the popular sports cartoonist for the New York World Telegram, Stanley Woodward, sports editor of the New York Herald Tribune, and Look Magazine's Tim Cohane. Lombardi slept in cabin number 2, also known as the Mother Lodge, which was where most of the fun was. Bull Pond was the quintessential male bonding experience of that time and culture. Every night, the campers gathered on the screened-in front porch as an Army Signal Corps projectionist ran Army football highlights and Hollywood films. This wasn't a particularly artsy crowd. They preferred Westerns and anything with Susan Hayward. Once, when Blake asked for a showing of Julius Caesar, most of the boys left to play cards and drink near the backroom bar, which was operated by the fun-loving Red Reader and never closed. No one wanted to stay in cabin number 1 with Blake, known to his cohorts as St. Blake. He didn't smoke or drink. Furthermore, according to Aki Kruger, Blake snored to beat hell. The group often took turns cooking. Lombardi and Mullen created a passable meal, by all accounts, but a gastronomic conspiracy of Blake, Woodward, and Cohane offered up a breakfast that tasted as if it had been cooked in a drain pipe, and a lunch that elicited the immortal query from Murray Warmoth, "Have I eaten this, or am I supposed to?" Along with the taciturn Blake, Lombardi was the poorest storyteller in the gang, but he laughed the loudest at the jokes, including his own. He was the best audience possible for Cohane, the erudite, pipe-smoking scotch drinker, who shared with his fellow Fordham grad a corny and romantic sense of humor. It was in the haze of a hangover one morning that summer that Cohane conceived the idea of a Bull Pond All-America team, the fictitious counterpart to the college all-star teams he selected with Grantland Rice. The sensibility of the Bull Pond All-America team reflected Cohane's perspective on major college football, which was shared by the others. He revered it, despite its flaws, which he preferred to deal with through jokes rather than hand-wringing editorials and official investigations. On that 1949 Bullpon team were players whose names made Lombardi laugh so hard that tears shot from his eyes. Excalibur Slime, the maniacally aggressive tackle from King Arthur's Knight School. Harry Dog Staggerfoot, the tipsy, broken field artist from 3 AM and M. Percy Smog, the X-ray-eyed quarterback from UCLA. Increase Yardage, the famed fullback and cum laude student in underwater finger painting from Harvard. And the favorite of both Lombardi and Cohane, Chuckles Axe Murder, the murderous end from Bedlam Hall. Not everyone loved Red Blake and his football program. His staff and players responded to him with reverence and undying loyalty. "You signed a lifetime contract with him," said Doug Kenna. But Blake had adversaries scattered around the country, in the press box, in the academies, and across the field, who considered him less than a saint. His critics complained that he was an egotist who would do anything to win, and that the brave old army team of the stirring fight song was not so brave after all. They played dirty, it was said, and bullied lesser teams on an easy schedule. Far from genuflecting to the Patriots along the Hudson during the Blanchard-Davis era at the end of World War II, some people questioned publicly why Army had such brilliant athletes playing a game when they could have been saving the world overseas. Even Blake's innovative two-platoon system was the object of scorn. The average football fan disapproved when Blake implemented his system in 1948. While Army was destroying Stanford 43-0 at Yankee Stadium that year, thousands booed every time Army switched platoons from offense to defense. Blake's critics had reached full voice by 1949. Army began the season impressively, destroying Davidson and Penn State in its first two games. The T formation, tutored by Lombardi, looked impressive, with Arnold Galiffa running the offense at quarterback. Galiffa was starting ahead of Blake's son, Bob, a talented sophomore who some alumni and sports writers thought was a smarter signal caller than Galiffa. But Blake was disinclined to start his son over a veteran of Galiffa's talent, which he felt was considerable. In one of his letters to MacArthur, he'd written, "In Galiffa, our quarterback and passer, we have a sharpshooter of unusual ability, who, aside from a temperament which goes with the Italian youngsters, has all the qualities of an All-American." West Point then was dominated by the Anglo-Saxon culture of men like Blake and MacArthur, and Italians were thought of in stereotypical fashion as fiery and emotional, which was more true of Lombardi than Galiffa. Early that season, Lombardi had encountered the prevailing attitude when Blake asked him to address the West Point Society of Retired Colonels and Generals in Manhattan. It was his first appearance before the brass, and Lombardi was nervous on the drive down. After showing game films and appraising the team, he thought he'd survive the ordeal when an old war horse rose from his chair and scolded him for starting Galiffa ahead of Bobby Blake. "The only reason you're playing Galiffa is because he's Italian," came the charge. Lombardi was so enraged by the accusation that he could feel the hair standing up on the back of his neck. He was never known for his quick wit, but this time he found an answer that calmed him down and made the others chuckle as well. "That's not the reason at all," Lombardi said. "I'm playing him because I'm Italian." In fact, Galiffa was starting because Red Blake wanted him to start. Lombardi, like his grouchy old critic, privately preferred Bob Blake at quarterback. For the third game of the season in early October, the Army team rode the train out to Ann Arbor to face Michigan in the college game of the year. Michigan was top-ranked, unbeaten in more than two seasons, And Blake had been preparing for this game for 10 months, since that first staff meeting on New Year's morning. Every down and distance tendency that Michigan had revealed in previous games, what play they most likely would run on 1st and 10, 3rd and long, 3rd and short, what plays they preferred from left formation, what plays they relied on in their own territory, in their opponent's territory, all of that had been seen on film and plotted before the season by Lombardi, Warmoth, and the other assistants, Kenna, Paul Amon, and Johnny Sauer. Perhaps Blake's finest staff ever, all but Kenna, who opted for the business world, became successful head coaches. They also studied the Michigan offensive players individually, scrutinizing their movements for inadvertent tip-offs of what play was coming. The laborious process of looking at film with scientific precision was a revelation to Lombardi, who had done little of it at Fordham and none at Saints. It's surprising how many players tipped by the position of their feet, the angle of their body. You could tell whether it was a wedge play, pass play, dive play, sweep, Lombardi said later. You see whether a lineman can be had to the inside. You make notes on paper and put books together on the formations and the personnel. The key discovery from the Michigan game films was that their defensive linemen were inordinately tall, with high centers of gravity. Army's offensive line could handle them by blocking low, coming in under the forearm charge. In the week before the game, Lombardi drilled the linemen relentlessly, taking the defensive position himself and having them charge at his shins and ankles. Such comprehensive analysis and adjustment would become routine among football coaches decades later, but it was rare then. It gave Blake an advantage on the field not unlike a card player who is expert at counting cards, competing against opponents relying on the luck of the draw. The talent or hand that's dealt is of primary importance, but analysis can make a crucial difference between consistent winning and losing. Blake's signature talent was using all this data to create something clean and simple. He had what Lombardi called the great knack of knowing what offensive plan to use against what defense, and then discarding the immaterial and going with the strength. All the detailed preparations resulted not in a mass of confusing statistics and plans, but in the opposite, paring away the extraneous, reducing and refining, until all that was left was what was needed for that game against that team. It was a lesson Lombardi never forgot, and the benefits of that system were apparent during the big game in Ann Arbor. Playing before a full house of 97,000 Michigan fans, Army defeated the seemingly invincible Wolverines 21-7. But the game did more than enhance Army's standing in the national polls. It also inflamed Blake's reputation for dirty play. During a reverse play, Michigan's passing right halfback, Chuck Ortman, was knocked unconscious as he was trying to make a block. To Michigan fans, Ortman's concussion became the symbol of West Point thuggery. After the game, the Michigan Daily printed an interview with W.H. Hobbs, an eminent professor of geology, who charged that Ortman had been kicked between the eyes by Army's fullback, Gil Stevenson. Hobbs wrote letters to colleagues around the country accusing Army of intentionally trying to cripple its opponents. He found an ally in a Harvard professor who watched Army defeat the Crimson 54-14 the following week and declared that in his 22 years working as an official, this Army team was the dirtiest he'd seen. Army had more mud slung at it than a dredge could discover under the Mississippi, wrote Blake's friendly scribe, Tim Cohane, in Look. Was it deserved? Army indisputably played a ferocious brand of football, its games marked by bruising tackles and bruised feelings. But Benny Oosterbaan, Michigan's coach, disagreed with Professor Hobbs, saying that Blake's team played hard but fairly. Game films later showed that Ortman had been accidentally clonked on the head by the knee of one of his own blockers, and he couldn't have been kicked by Stevenson in any case, since Stevenson played only offense that day. Army's notoriety as a corps of bullies had been established nonetheless, and only spread further as the season progressed. A few more members of the New York Press Corps joined the anti-Blake chorus after the cadets overwhelmed Columbia 63-6. The next day's game stories sounded like reports from the front, elbows flying, Columbia players staggering from the field in a daze. This served as mere warm-up for the commotion at Mitchie Stadium